State budgets get slashed.
And lawmakers race for the border.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's February 18th.
Coming up, we'll talk to a presidential historian about the last round of Social Security negotiations back in the Reagan era. Also, some states are looking to the Civil War for answers to their economic problems.
But first, let's talk budget cuts today. They're looking for Democrats in Madison, Wisconsin, as part of a plan to deal with a $3.6 billion budget gap. The Republican governor there and GOP lawmakers need just one Democrat to allow for a quorum in the State House. That vote would let a bill pass in the legislature that would weaken the state workers' union. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch. She's with us from New York, as she is every Friday. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Why is the governor in Wisconsin proposing this change?
Well, you know, unlike the federal government, by law, states can't operate with a deficit. Think of the situation as if it's a family that's facing financial problems, mm-hmm. but can't use a credit card as a safety net. States have to make deep cuts in spending. Everything from pensions to programs are on the table.
Is this, Jill, just about Wisconsin, though, or is this going to spread, do you think, to other states?
I think this is going to spread. There are similar battles being waged from big states like New York and California and Illinois down to the little ones like Rhode Island. States, cities, and municipalities are simply getting crushed by the unrealistic promises made during the boom times.
And they're finding anything that they can to do this, to get these budgets in balance, right?
Absolutely. And if we go back to our family analogy, if you made a promise of a donation when things were good, but then you lost your job, you'd have to renege on that promise.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, another Republican governor is dealing with his state's budget crisis by nixing federal funds for high-speed rail. Florida's Rick Scott said he's rejecting $2.4 billion of money from the federal government for a rail line between Orlando and Tampa. But now an influential group of lawmakers is trying to salvage the line. From the Transportation Nation public radio project at station WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
One of the people caught off guard was John Mica, the Republican chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee.
I was taken aback. I had about 15, 20 minutes to argue my points.
He wants to give the private sector a chance to complete the rail line.
No risk to the taxpayers, no additional cost to the state of Florida.
At least eight groups have expressed interest in paying the $300 million needed to complete the line, plus any cost overruns. Democratic Florida U.S. Senator Bill Nelson says responsibility for the project would be transferred from the state of Florida to another public agency.
We are looking at several. Amtrak is one.
But the money would come from an international construction firm. They want to get in on the beginning of what may be a much longer rail line that extends to Miami. The U.S. Department of Transportation says the Congress members have a week to put together a deal or the $2.4 billion goes elsewhere. New York and California are clamoring for the money. I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Now to the big economic issue of the week, inflation. The government said this week that consumer prices here in the U.S. rose by almost 0.5% in January. China said inflation was up 5% last month, and the U.K. said prices rose 4%.
Dan Cook is CEO of IG Markets, and he joins me now in the studio here in New York. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
So is this inflation we're hearing about this week, is this a cause for concern, do you think?
I think it is a cause for concern. It's not so much the level that the inflation is at, but the rate at which it's climbing, at least here in the United States. Places like China, they've been taking measures to try to stem that. But rising prices, definitely when we're trying to, you know, get the teeth into our economic recovery, is definitely a concern.
And one of the big things that is causing the core rate to rise is that gas prices are going up. And this is something that a lot of economists look at and they say this is the sort of thing that could stifle a recovery. Do you come down on that, thinking that gas prices going up could stop our recovery in its tracks?
Well, certainly gas prices, oil prices more specifically, as they climb, I mean, we look at everything. It impacts everyone. The consumer, the gas pump, the manufacturers is a huge concern. We've seen a good recovery or at least more stabilization in manufacturing. But if oil prices start to go to $110, $120 a barrel, it definitely hurts the recovery.
All right, let's talk about the other big issue this week, debt. The European debt crisis is flaring up again today. And There are protesters in Wisconsin and all over the country. Governors and states are trying to deal with big problems with debt. Should we be worried about that?
It is a really tough situation, and I often joke with our European economists. They say, well, yeah, we've got Portugal and Ireland, but you guys have California and Illinois. It is a tough situation, and one that, when you don't have the recovery behind it, makes it even a little bit more perilous. And so it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Do you think that Americans are going to be ready to accept the kinds of cuts that politicians say are going to be needed?
Well, I think our hearts would be into it, and we could see that, but I think it's going to be a much more difficult road than what we even guess right now.
Dan Cook, CEO of IG Markets, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, February 18th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. Well, celebrations are going on in Cairo today, marking a week since the president stepped down. And the economy is slowly getting back to normal. Thousands are on the streets with businesses hoping they'll buy some stuff. And the stock market hoping traders will buy some shares.
The BBC's Rob Young is with us now from central Cairo with the latest. Hi, Rob.
Hi, hello.
So when the market does indeed open, what's likely to happen? Are we talking a big buying spree or a sell-off?
Well, many analysts think that the market will continue its slide because there are still so many unanswered questions about the way Egypt will be run in the future. However, there is a Facebook campaign to try and persuade Egyptians to spend as much money as they can buying shares. More than 16,000 people have already agreed to sign up on Facebook and buy shares. Well, in the center of busy Cairo, I spoke to the woman behind the Facebook campaign, Sarah Hashlameh, and she told me why this campaign is so important.
When people see that we as Egyptians, we have faith in our stock market, we have faith in our economy, this will definitely reflect and have its implications on the whole world.
But they may well be no match for international investors who, say some analysts, will continue to pull their cash out of Cairo.
Hey, Rob, how are businesses coping there?
Well, if you ignore the tanks, there is a sense of normality here in Cairo. The shops are open and the street sellers are back in business. But the banks, they've been told to stay shut. It's estimated that weeks of protests have cost this country's tourism, construction and manufacturing industries more than $1.5 billion.
The BBC's Rob Young in Cairo. Rob, thanks.
Thank you.
From the relatively small Cairo Stock Exchange to what could be the world's biggest. Now the New York Stock Exchange, merged with the German benchmark, have a problem. What the two are going to be called.
Our European correspondent Stephen Beard joins us now from London with more on this story. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So why has the name become such a big problem?
There are national sensitivities here. After all, a German company is taking over an iconic American institution. By rights, it should be a German name, but perhaps a non-threatening, unnationalistic, culturally acceptable German name. One jokey suggestion I've seen so far was Stocktoberfest. economist Andrew Hilton thinks it should perhaps be a little more classical.
I would suggest that you simply choose as the holding company name the name of a good German. Find a good German. Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Goethe, something like that. Write it in capital letters. Bach would be very nice because it would be very short, and call the exchange Bach.
Oh, yeah, Bach. That'll go over really well on Wall Street, Stephen.
Indeed. And the senior Democrat senator for New York has already said, Charles Schumer, has made it clear that New York has got to be in the name, right, and it's got to be first. This is obviously going to be a major headache for the two companies. So they've turned to social media like Facebook for help. They've thrown the search for a new name open to the social networks for brainstorming by their employees, much cheaper than using a brand consultant.
Well, let's see what ideas get written on their wall. Stephen Beard, our Marketplace Europe correspondent, thanks so much.
Okay, Jeremy.
And Jeremy, from the Marketplace Spoiled Food Desk.
Oh, I didn't realize we had a desk.
Yes, we do.
Like
we
that.
Do. It's right down the hall, actually. It's next to my office. The Guinness Book of World Records has identified the world's oldest wedding cake.
Oh.
I don't like putting the word old and food next to one another, but
it doesn't really.
In this case, it works. It's 100, this cake is 113 years old.
Wow, that must have been quite a wedding.
It was baked in 1898. By the way, that is the 19th century.
Yep.
50 years before Tupperware was even invented. So it's on display at the Willis Museum in England. A sampling of this cake, it's indeed fruit cake, by the way. And it shows that the dessert is still moist inside after 113 years. The outer shell, however, this is the frosting part of it. The frosting has since hardened, probably hardened 100 years ago. The frosting is cracked. Do you know why the frosting is cracked on the outside?
I have no idea.
It was the Blitzkrieg from World War II.
It's quite a cake.
To crack. You're listening to the Midday Update for February 18th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. On Twitter, by the way, at Radio Chio. Happy Friday, Jeremy.
Happy Friday, Steve. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York and on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson. And by the way, I would like to thank all of the Midday Podcast listeners who went to our Facebook page yesterday and friended APM Facebook and helped us get over a key goal. And if you want to know what that goal is, you'll just have to go and friend APM Facebook, and you'll see what number of followers we're at.
Just don't poke us there.
No, definitely do not poke us.
Well, President Obama's federal budget proposal doesn't include any cuts to Social Security. A lot of folks in Washington, Jeremy, say real budget solutions have to start with shoring up that entitlement program, something Republicans and Democrats came together for way back in 1983. That's when President Ronald Reagan and House Speaker Tip O'Neill helped save the program from going broke. Julian Zelizer is a presidential historian at Princeton University. He's with us now to talk about that moment in history. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Talk about what happened in that Social Security deal from the early 1980s between President Reagan and Speaker Tip O'Neill.
The 1983 reforms were very important and very dramatic. Congress made the decision to solve a short-term imbalance in the program where we didn't have enough money coming in compared to what we were spending. Benefits were cut, taxes were raised, and Republicans and Democrats entered into a bipartisan agreement that fixed the program and got it on sound footing.
Well, it didn't quite fix it because here we are nearly 30 years later and we're talking about many of the same things that we were talking about then, right?
That's absolutely true. The 1983 reform was about a short-term problem. Literally, the program was about to run out of money. And that crisis, which was more immediate still than the one we face today, placed a lot of pressure, not just on Democrats and Republicans, but moderates in both parties to come out and take rather courageous stands at the time to find a solution.
What can we learn from that today, then?
Well, I think the first is that reform is possible. The fact is Social Security was reformed in 1983. It was reformed in 1977. And it was also reformed many times before that, since its creation in 1935. It's very important that there's going to be leaders, meaning members of Congress and the White House, who are willing to do what their party doesn't want them to do.
And could something like that happen today? I mean, you say it takes leadership and courage. Do you see leaders and courageous people out there?
Sometimes, you know, history takes you by surprise. You don't see the leaders today. You don't see the bipartisanship. But this program is enormously popular. And one thing that Republicans and Democrats understand is that there will be payback for both parties if the system breaks. And so I think that pressure can counteract the polarization we see in Washington.
Presidential historian Julian Zelizer from Princeton University. Julian, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, Steve, do you know what this year is?
2011.
2011. It's 150 years since the start of the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
And as Ricky Bevington reports now from Georgia Public Broadcasting, some recession-scarred but history-filled communities are using the anniversary as a tourism opportunity.
In the small town of Milledgeville, the former state capital of Georgia, politicians debate whether to leave the United States.
Shall the people of Georgia secede from the Union In consequence of the election of Mr. Lincoln to the presidency of the United States.
This is one of many reenactments celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. In states from Maryland to Texas, museums, historical sites, not to mention hotels, restaurants, and gas stations, want to draw the business of heritage tourists.
It's a $192 billion business.
Tourism market researcher Laura Mandela says Americans who plan vacations to cultural and historic sites spend an average of $994 a trip. That's a third more than the average leisure vacationer.
I know souvenirs is the number two category of purchase. You know, shopping's number one.
Mandela says 80% of heritage tourists plan their trips online. So that's where communities with a historic past are working to get their attention. I've logged on to the website of the Georgia Historical Society, and I'm typing in the Civil War topic that I'm interested in. Sherman's March to the Sea. Up pops a map with driving directions, and it even has suggestions for hotels and restaurants.
We've made history sites into commercial sites for actually centuries now.
Yale University American History professor Dr. David Blight is an author of the upcoming Civil War website by the National Park Service. The federal government oversees 70 Civil War historic sites and battlefields, and they attract up to 12 million visitors a year. But so many tourists, Blight says, creates what he calls a dilemma between commemorating history and making money off of it.
No one can drive into Gettysburg without seeing 50 billboards on the way in.
And since maintaining historic sites isn't cheap, making the past part of a billion-dollar market may be the best way to preserve it. In Atlanta, I'm Ricky Bevington for Marketplace.
Well, the NBA All-Star Game is this weekend, but the real matchup will be off the court. We've reported on the labor talks going on in professional football, but as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins tells us, the negotiations going on between players and owners in pro basketball may be even more intense.
On the one side, you've got players like LeBron James. He's sitting on a $110 million contract. On the other, you've got the NBA teams, which reportedly took in around $4 billion last year. Sports economist Alan Sanderson looks at it this way.
There are two pigs, there's one trough. It's just how fast can you eat?
And the league is saying players are eating too much. The NBA says owners stand to lose $350 million this year. Owners want to cut player salaries and benefits by about a third. David Barry is an economist at Southern Utah University.
The owners have taken what I would think is a fairly radical position.
Barry blames the economic downturn for team losses. The players also question the league's accounting and aren't eager to take a pay cut.
I just find it hard to believe we're going to reach some kind of an agreement. I think they're probably going to have to stop the games.
The league's current contract with players expires at the end of June. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, of course, there is no one who can replace Oprah.
Oh,
Steve.
No.
No, nobody can replace Oprah. But two people in Chicago are going to try anyway.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Two? Wow,
two of
okay.
them. It's going to take two people. Four feet to fill Oprah's shoes. Local TV reporters Ryan Chiaverini and Valerie Warner, get used to those names.
Chiaverini, that sounds like maybe he's a distant relative.
They're going to be taking Oprah's time slot after the last Oprah Winfrey Show airs in May.
Okay.
Now, let's hope, first of all, that they have good taste in books.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be probably reading a lot of their books now.
Yeah.
And allow me to be the first, Steve, to predict some serious squabbles when these two anchors figure out that they are not making as much as their predecessor.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the salary's going to be the same.
That paycheck has some big shoes to fill, actually. So,
but you know, if the audience isn't happy with them, they could always just give everyone a car again.
You get a car.
In New York, carless. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Oh, I have a car, and I drive it everywhere in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.